Hello and welcome to a new podcast from We The 15, the biggest ever human rights movement aiming to end discrimination of persons with disabilities, who make up 15% of the world's population. We The 15, Access All Areas, is made by the same team behind A Winning Mindset, Lessons from the Paralympics, which was the award-winning official podcast of the International Paralympic Committee. My name is Andy Stevenson, I'm a sports broadcaster, and I happen to have a disability myself. Join me in this new series as we take a look at society and investigate how attitudes can be changed to create more opportunities for persons with disabilities, as well as improving representation and amplifying a range of diverse voices. This second episode of the We The 15 podcast is all about technology and innovation. And this, to me, is an area that affects all people with disabilities. I'm sure we have all at one point or another used a piece of technology or come up with something, perhaps ourselves, that has made our lives just that little bit easier. And our two guests today are Bernard Shearer, in Nairobi in Kenya. He is the director and co-founder of the Global Disability Innovation Hub's Innovate Now program. He is also somebody who has lived with brittle bones and scoliosis since he was born. And Simon Urier is from an organization called Senior Descent. He is the man behind an inclusive animated character called Ben the Koala, who, as we'll hear, teaches children, especially those with autism. Hello to you both. And thank you for sparing the time.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. It's great to be here. Thanks.
I've mentioned technology and innovation because technology has a part to play in every facet of our lives. What's the thing that you use in your everyday life that people are most amazed by?
I'm not sure they're amazed by it, but I use crutches. That's how I get around. But I guess sometimes people are amused that I would need to bring a cushion when sitting at the table, for example. Because when I sit at the table, sometimes the table is too high and the seat is too low. I guess there isn't specifically innovations I've seen around this, although I know there are adjustable chairs and tables that can go up and down, but it's not what you'll find regularly in restaurants or office spaces.
It's funny because here we are talking about technology and innovation, and then something as simple as a pair of crutches, you know, or a cushion helps you. And kind of empathize with that because, you know, I've got plenty of sciencey stuff that I use, but there's also some really basic things in my life that I use as well. And Bernard, tell us about Innovate Now. Tell us what it is and what's its purpose.
Yeah, Innovate Now is a startup accelerator. We help entrepreneurs across Africa design, build, and launch assistive technology ventures. And really, Innovate Now was set up to kind of test what works in driving local innovation and local industry. Because as I mentioned, you know, for something as basic as crutches, in some parts of the world, AT users do not have access to crutches. And the other thing is that a lot of the assistive tech in this part of the world, users do not have many options. So a lot of the time, AT users in Africa are denied a great product experience. So we help startups to think about AT, not just from a medical or a clinical perspective, but that it's a product and it's going to be used by a customer, really, not just a user who has preferences, who desires a great product experience. And I think this is really what has been missing. So we set out Innovate Now in 2019 and have supported 45 startups over that time period. We have a community of 100 plus entrepreneurs that have been trained at Innovate Now from across 11 countries. And this is helping to shift the mindset, the markets, and everything else around assisting technology so that it can really work for those who need it.
We will definitely get round to talking about the issue of accessibility to innovation in the developing world later on. But now I want to bring in Simon Urier, who I believe your work involving disability began, Simon, by making innovations for deaf people. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in 2003, with a bunch of friends, actually, we just decided to make something. And my background was about innovation in sciences. So I just use the same method. So I started to innovate for deaf people and help them get the information. So, and especially using sign language. So that's how everything started. And step by step is what was interesting is that we thought years after year that we were starting to become specialized about deafness. And interesting thing is that we started to see people who were not concerned by deafness come to us because they were trying and wanting to use the tools we were inventing for deaf people with other disabilities, but also without any disabilities. So we started to move from a perspective of, I would say, accessibility to universal design, because we just faced it. Like we, people asked for it. So step by step, we moved to this position of designing through different experiences and to produce new products, new services that would fit the needs of different kind of people. And I think it's exactly what Bernard says about like the needs for a more like a more universal design, just because everybody is in the same boat. It's not a different part of the world. It's just a world. And usually design was addressed to people with no special needs, if we consider like this about disabilities. But step by step, the idea is to say, okay, we are more on the boat than you think. So you have to design for a wider range of people and needs, but needs also create opportunities. So they can give you so many inputs, like so many things that will tackle your creativity and push you forward. And that's what designs need, is like inputs and I would say like, things to resolve, like things that are really hard, then you can push your creativity farther, etc. So that's why what we've done.
Can you give us a specific example of something that you created for deaf people that then, you know, became a much wider thing?
Yeah, for instance, we worked on books for children with deafness. And interesting thing that we were pushed to a different way of giving information, etc. And we started to work with people with mental disabilities because we worked a lot on visual things connected to oral things, connected to written languages, etc. So other population and also population coming from abroad, because newcomers who were not able to speak French and read it, sometimes children came just in a day and then they have to adapt and learn in special schools. And they started to use our material because everybody was going through the visual things and then going to the French. So it was really interesting to see how we are all interconnected and stop putting some like cycles. Okay, you are in part of this, you are part of this group and you are part of this group, etc. No, actually we are all connected and we have to refresh that idea.
And in this interview, I could be forgiven for calling you Ben, because you are now known for, and I would urge people listening to if you're listening to the podcast, maybe if you've got your phone or tablet or something, look up Ben the Koala, because I have it in front of me, and Ben is a very friendly looking animated koala, but Ben has a very serious purpose, Simon.
Yeah, that's another example we've done. Like 10 years ago, we started to work on Ben. And the story is like, actually it's my favorite one about what we've done. Because at first I was giving a conference about what we were doing about deaf people and accessibility, et cetera. And at the end of it, two parents came to me and they had a child with autism. And they said, okay, have you ever tried your stuff about on public with autism, et cetera? So I said, no, but obviously I would so much love it. So let's do something. And then we started to work with them and then other families and professionals, etc. And we started to work on what we could do about it, autism. And they say, okay, the first thing we want to work on is learn to brush your teeth, because it's a very hard gesture for kids with autism. And it's really critical, because if you don't brush your teeth, then you have many other problems that comes to you. So, okay, we started on this question, how can we teach children with autism from 2 to 6 to learn to brush their teeth? I was like 1 year and a half of work, like design work, etc. And at the end, we created Ben. And the idea was quite simple, is to say, okay, Ben is making the gesture in a very simple way, very basic one, etc. And the kid is learning by imitation. And it worked Actually, and the interesting point of the story is that obviously it worked on kids with autism because we designed it with the families, etc. So it was okay. But the first day we launched the app on the App Store, there was, I think there were 800 downloads, but we just had 20 families to test it. And we did not make any communication, etc. It was really like, just like that. And all these 800 downloads were just people with no connection to disability, any kind of disabilities. They were just parents looking for something to help their kids to learn to brush their teeth. So I think we had more than 350,000 downloads of the app through the years. And I think there's maybe 6% of people with autism in the global part. So that's really the most interesting example I have, because usually I give conferences and people say, oh, you are the one about Ben. Oh, great. We used it with our kids. And we didn't know it was coming from people with autism. And I say, yeah, that's a good point of the story. It's just we are connected. We are together and we have to work together because you are benefiting from it. It's not to give someone else a chance. It's to give us a chance. And that's the point for me. It's like to remember that we need to give us a chance through the participation of everybody. Universal design is for everyone. We just need it. Everyone needs it. Nobody knows that text message were invented for deaf people. They don't tell the story.
It's brilliant. I'm looking at Ben now. I was watching one of the videos earlier, and it's the classic invention of simplicity, but absolutely does exactly what you need it to do.
Yeah. We had experiment, and it was showing that in 6 weeks of use, the kids with autism or neurodevelopmental issues had an increase of 40% of autonomy on the gesture. It was amazing. Like only six weeks, I think, something like that. So, you know, very simple things can make a difference sometimes. And technology is just a way to just enhance the possibilities. It's great.
And Bernard, with Ben the Koala being an online resource, I'm assuming that's something that the majority of people in Africa could use just as easily as anybody else around the world. But are there still things where there are restrictions on the access in Africa that maybe we would take for granted in Europe, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I really love that example because, you know, sometimes when you think about assistive technology and accessibility, people tend to think it's very complicated tech and kind of like, you know, next gen kind of stuff, very expensive. But really what Simone just explained there is actually, it tends to be the most useful and practical technology when it's easy to find, easy to use, can be used by everybody. With connectivity today, I think the possibilities really to build a more equitable world can be achieved because we have, even at Innovate Now, adopted an online first approach to how we reach entrepreneurs across the continent. And this actually happened during COVID-19 when we realized that we couldn't continue with our in-person programs. So we use the internet today. We use our, you know, digital platforms to train entrepreneurs on AT entrepreneurship, to conduct our mentoring programs. And that has really enabled us to reach 9 countries in Africa. So I think what we need today is to look at, of course, we have the challenges, but also to not forget the opportunity side. You know, you can never have like a perfect situation, but I think within the resources and the connectivity that's available today, it's pretty easy to have solutions like Ben created maybe in France being used right here in Kenya. And I think I've seen many examples as well of this.
Just changing subject slightly, Bernard, when I assume you get kind of things sent to the Global Disability Innovation Hub of great ideas from around the world. Do you get the sense that a lot of the products that are created are actually being created by disabled people themselves as a way of solving their own problems, if you like?
So the way we've approached AT innovation or disability innovation at Innovate Now is really, I would say, a universal kind of approach to it, because we don't restrict and say, okay, it only has to be disabled people. But what we really insist on is lived experience, you know, in some shape or form. You cannot solve a problem facing persons with disabilities without, you know, proper lived experience. So in many cases, we have founders who have disabilities themselves. But in other many cases, we have founders who do not have a disability themselves, but might have a team member, for example, who has a disability, who provides this crucial aspect of designing products for persons with disabilities. Or, for example, a lot of our startups are also inspired by, you know, family members or friends that experienced or had a disability, and they decided to do something about it and create a solution for, you know, a larger group of people. But I think we are always very, you know, concerned about, you know, designing for rather than with, because when you do things like design and you know, creating new innovations without involving the target group that you're designing for, a lot of the times it really doesn't work. So we have an approach that we call Live Labs, where every innovator going through the accelerator program has to do validation and testing in the communities where they are innovating for. And that tends to, in many cases, shape the direction of the product, sometimes a little bit different from how they came into the program, just because they involved the would-be or the to-be users. And this makes all the difference.
Simon, I think I'm right in saying you don't have a disability yourself. What is it about this area, if you like? What's your motivation for trying to help people with all kinds of impairments? What's the sort of driving force behind the work you do with Senior Dessin?
I think that was a long question for me. Like, it took me years to answer that question, but now I think I can be quite clear about it. When I met the deaf guy, I think I realized that there were so many people living around me that was like unknown countries. I mean, they had this experience of life, this way of life, this way of communicating. And for deaf people, you also have this cultural aspect, etc. So I was feeling like, okay, I can travel so close to myself. It's just around. So I just have to connect to new people that maybe are not present in my actual life and just get curious about what they live, what they want, what we could do together. And the idea was also to be just quite honest, because relationships are based about like exchanges. I was feeling I was rediscovering things. And also I love to solve problems, which is my pleasure in everyday life. So I felt we could do very, very great stuff together. So that's just really the way I started it. As Bernard said, to us, like, our baseline is innovation through disabilities. So it's always at the basis of everything we do. We have people with disabilities involved. We have people with disabilities in the team. But also we work with other group of people, because we usually work as a coalition, so like consortium, to work on the subject. And we do it at very different levels. I mean, we do it at a product level, at a service level, and at a public policies design level. So, for instance, I also gave lessons about universal design to create more inclusive policies. Because everything is the same way. To say, okay, you want to build new policies, then bring in the loop people who really lack of access to public policies. And these people will help us create like interesting, inclusive, and efficient policies. So it's always the same value proposition, but in different kind of design. And I think one of the key points about this to change how things happen is to make design more accessible to people with disabilities. I mean, if you have design schools, they should be able to welcome people with disabilities to be trained as designers, to be trained as innovators. Then you can have people with disabilities invent new stuff, etc. The idea also is not to confuse your experience in life and your skills. And innovation is a way of thinking, a way of doing. You have to train, and these schools need to be more accessible to make inclusive innovation just more common. I think that's a key point.
Yeah, this is the thing, because having to be creative and coming up with solutions is something that I think every disabled person does every day. It's, you know, we're basically inventors. We're inventors and creators every day, not necessarily on a professional basis, of course, but just in our own homes. And as you touched on there, it's positive to hear that you have disabled people working in your team. Is that something that's always been the case, or has that increased in recent years?
I think, no, we've always done that. At first, it was all benevolent. So we were all just engaged in the project, and step by step, we had professionalized the activity, etc. So we started to have salaries and people with or without disabilities. And now step by step, we are also adapting, because some people with disabilities, sometimes they have another job, or sometimes they have, like, they can work, but only part-time jobs, etc. So we try to adapt the way we can work together with sometimes part-time things, or sometimes just a commission for 2 days. You know, it's, we are just adapting things and helping them get knowledges and get skills step by step. So yeah, we have so many different ways of having different people on board. But thing is to say that, as you said, actually we are all creative through life, because actually human beings are made to be creative, because otherwise we have been like erased from the earth. So we have to be creative. And then I think training just gives you methods and tools and strategies and networks to make something more organized, I would say, like not a spontaneous creativity, but a process of creativity that will lead to innovation. And that's also the difference between improvisation and innovation. It's that long path between you have an idea and you have an innovation.
I don't know if you agree, Bernard, but social media, I think, is helping in this area, because let's say Instagram or Facebook, I could put a video up of me using, as I do, a tennis wristband. I put that around my arm and that holds a pen or a fork or whatever. And if I put a video of that up, potentially hundreds, maybe even thousands of people around the world with similar challenges to me would see that, and they might go, oh, wow, okay, I can use that as well. Is that something that you're seeing, Bernard, where social media has become a bit of a game changer?
Yeah, I mean, that's really incredible. And I think, you know, when you think about digital social media and the ability of people to connect on the internet, it opens a lot of possibilities. For assistive technology specifically, I think digital channels, you know, like social media, is one of the low-hanging fruits to create awareness, because awareness is usually one of the biggest gaps we have when it comes to disability and assistive tech, but also how to reach more people. I think we live in a day and age where even if you're just a regular brick and mortar shop, you really have to learn how to use social media and digital marketing to reach more people. And I think this is one of the greatest needs we have when it comes to persons with disabilities, is how do you reach them? How do you actually create mechanisms of people to learn what's available, you know, what they could use, and how do you actually get it to them? Yeah, so it's definitely like one of those, I would say, tools that innovators need to learn how to leverage on, because it's about reach, it's about awareness, and it's one of the most effective ways to do that in an increasingly digital world and connected world.
We're in the technology episode, so I have to ask you both about AI or artificial intelligence, and how do you both see AI affecting the work you do, for good or bad? Simon, maybe I'll start with you.
Actually, AI is just a tool, so everything depends on what you do with it, and always the same. We have three kind of areas where we try to use the AI. The first one is to simplify the text, you know, so you have many new development about getting a text in this original format and then translating it into plain English, if it's English, but like a more accessible way of expressing things. So I really like this topic, because it would make a lot of difference for especially people with mental disabilities or people with illiteracy, etc. So I like this. The second area we're working on is gesture recognition, so for sign language, to see how it can impact the ability for tech to translate sign language into text. But in the contrary, but obviously honestly, it's like 15 years past to find that.
So as in somebody would be able to do sign language to a camera and it turns it into a, well, it could be an essay, I suppose, for school, or it could be a book, or okay, wow. That's
and amazing. The contrary, to make the web more accessible, for instance. So you have a text and you can have an avatar, which is interpreting it in sign language. But we are really far from being able to do that, but still it's interesting to work on it. And the third step, and it is connected to Ben Lokola, it's about, and it's not about accessibility directly, but it's about identifying the progress of the kids, where they can, when they learned, where they didn't, and what we can recommend them and have a more personalized experience for learning, which would be a really interesting part for universal learning, you know, like universal design of learning. That would be a huge path if we could connect what the kid is doing, where he succeeds or not, and then what kind of recommendation we can take, do this activity for now and do this three times. So I'm really interested in that.
And Bernard?
Yeah, so obviously AI is, I mean, it's considered now as the next leap in terms of technological advancement. And I think the last 2 years or so have kind of started producing very practical and, you know, use of AI, and the way I'm seeing AI in our work is at different levels, right? So as an organization, obviously, there's a lot of tools that we use, whether that's providing access to education, mentoring, or just running our operations as an accelerator and as an innovation organization. But I think when it comes to persons with disabilities, I tend to look at AI from the lens of like having a companion. And I think this is kind of the approach you're seeing with things like Copilot and others. And why I feel like this could be super interesting for persons with disabilities is the idea of reducing complexity in performing different tasks online. And I think this is a real, you know, I guess, opportunity to look at how can AI be, you know, leveraged, you know, for persons with disabilities from an assistive tech perspective or from a just like daily use perspective, whether it's like writing, if you're writing essays or if you're, you know, designing stuff. Now you could do it with much less barriers because it's the fact that there's multiple ways and not just one ways of getting a task done. You have like prompts, which can be both voice based or, you know, like input based on a keyboard. Like these are the options that I think AI is bringing. And I feel like every person with disability should at least be educate themselves or be educated about how to use everyday tools, AI based tools to make their work easier. Because this then lowers the barriers to, you know, whether it's access to education, work, which are some of the biggest challenges we have for persons with disabilities. But lastly, I'd also want to say that we are increasingly seeing the application of AI in building assistive products themselves. I think, for example, what Simon mentioned about, you know, how do you bring sign language interpretation, you know, online. I think this is one area where there's a lot of activity. We actually have a portfolio company from our fourth cohort that has been trying to build this. But I think more interestingly for me is just seeing how the use of AI has been used in trying to solve certain problems. So I think we're going to see maybe potentially more, I would say, effective AT products, but I also see challenges, right? So, and mostly it's around privacy, it's around ethics, and it's around maybe things that we really don't know yet. Because for example, when it comes to brain implant technology, we don't know currently what are all the potential problems with that. But you can see that's where the technology is really being applied. I think you've seen what Elon Musk and others are doing. And of course, the use case is always disability, because when you are able to solve for disability, you actually open the pathways for, you know, inclusive and universal design, where everybody else now finds it so much easier to get stuff done.
It feels a good time to return to the question of the imbalance across the world of access to technology. I've got a stat here. The World Health Organization says that more than 2.5 billion people will need one or more assistive technologies by 2030. But they predict that 1 billion of those people, so just under half, won't actually be able to easily access those products. What can be done about that, Bernard? What's being done to put that right and to enable people in developing parts of the world to access technology just as easily as we might in the USA, Europe, Japan?
Yeah, so there's a lot happening. There's a lot of initiative towards trying to understand that and address it. And one of them is looking at how do we help governments and countries to prioritize disability inclusion and for countries to actually strengthen their systems, because part of the reasons people don't have access to assistive technology in many parts of the world is because it's never been a priority for many governments, and there's systemic exclusion, if I may call it that, across different levels, you know, and it starts at the top. So if countries do not have data, for example, around disabilities, if countries don't have health systems that are enabling people to access assistive technology, then this is why we have this problem. But one of the most biggest, I guess, barriers we have is market failures, because in countries like Kenya and many other African countries, the legacy of access to assistive technology is one of charity, right? So people get assistive technology through donations. We all know that even though donors and people of goodwill donate from a good heart, we know they are not experts in checking what am I actually giving? Is it going to do harm or not? And we've seen donations that actually do more harm than good, because, you know, it wasn't the right product, it wasn't of the right quality, and, you know, you have this cycle going on and on.
As in products have broken or put the person using them in a position of risk, I suppose?
Yes, and it's both, yeah. So you have products that break, you know, easily, or, you know, are not able to like give full utility. And we've also seen people basically, it's created also this culture where people actually don't know they deserve a great product experience and it's their right, you know, like people just accept anything because it's being given. And so we have companies that are trying to change that narrative and say, actually free is not really free, because you're also accepting, you know, substandard product. So how do we create that mindset shift? Part of the work that's happening, for example, is 80Scale is doing a lot of work with the governments, and 80Scale is the global partnership on assistive technology that's really trying to drive that political will and commitment. But there's also a lot happening on the kind of, you know, like market side, you know, with a lot of market shaping studies that have been done to show that we can't just address this from a policy or government responsibility only. We have to encourage local production. We have to encourage local industry and also enable a trade around this in a more effective way. And of course, innovation, right? And innovation, really, I like how Simon put it, is really an outcome, right? But how do you create an enabling environment for that outcome to happen? So at Innovate Now, what you've done is to provide a lot of this training on you know, entrepreneurship, on digital skills, and to really create an, you know, an ecosystem. I think one of the things about this is that it has to be collaborative. And I think that the challenge has been, while there's been many actors, there's been very little collaboration and looking at this things from the same page. So all these initiatives, for me, it goes back to three principles that I want to summarize very quickly. One is this has to be with persons with disabilities. So we have to give power back. The agency of persons with disability has to be there from the grassroots to the decision-making tables. Then number two is to kind of look at things through an ecosystem and innovation lens, and to say we have to build or adopt a very entrepreneurial mind, if I might call it, that because anything that has ever been solved in this world was by an entrepreneur. The products we use, the services we use. So how do we start thinking about that in this area? And then the third trend is really around this idea of universal design and inclusive design, because when you look at the needs of persons with disabilities, it's not just assistive products, right? It's everything else. You know, people want to access healthcare. They want to access, you know, even entertainment. You know, sometimes people don't think about it from, you know, what kind of society have we built and does everybody have access to it? So there's so much to be done around creating and helping organizations, individuals, leaders adopt this new way of thinking so that when they're making that decision on how much should I invest in this, they're not just looking at it from, oh, wait a minute, how many people need it? Because this is what I've seen. Like one of the senators in Kenya, she's visually impaired, and she was trying to make a case for the parliament to invest in some assistive technologies. But you see how government departments traditionally budget is that they ask for the numbers. So they ask, how many blind people do we have? And this is a totally wrong way of thinking about this, because you're doing it so that should there be a blind legislator in future, they will be able to do their work. And it's not about looking at it like only for people with disabilities, but looking at it that if we design things in an accessible and inclusive way, we enable everybody. The markets can be so much bigger. It's not just persons with disabilities. And this is the work that we are doing, pushing for innovation, pushing for entrepreneurship, and building these communities of practice.
Well, we have an episode of this We the 15 podcast coming next week about politics. So that's a very good anecdote to throw in there, Bernard. Simon, if I can ask you a connected but just sort of slightly different question, which is, do you think these big brands are doing enough in the field of inclusive or universal design? And actually, I suppose to be fair, I should say that there is actually a lot going on from some of the brands, and I think things are improving. But do you think enough is being done?
I think it's so much better than 20 years ago. So I would just first like enjoy that. Still, I feel like, and I think the same in the public sector, as Bernard said with his example, it's still a problem of mindset. I think we are starting to leave the era of caregiving, of being nice to people with disabilities. So we can feel a shift, but still, people, I think, at the top level are still feeling like it's a great thought. That's not real. It's like nice to think that.
Yes.
But it's not possible to implement it really in the process of the everyday work of the company or of the public sector. So I think we still have to work, and I think that's exactly what Bernard's doing. But we still have to work on the two sides. So build experiences to show that it is real. It's not something we want people to believe in. It's existing. And on the other side, we have to work on educating the strategists. We have to educate the top leaders, no matter if they are in the private or the public sector, with concrete example from the first part, and also give them strategies to say, okay, we can move from where you are to where we should be, and everybody will benefit from it. So that's really the thing I think we still have to do. But huge tech companies are, I think, maybe more advanced on that, because technologies has benefited a lot from disability. So I think they have these examples, etc. Everybody knows that some mobile phones, quite well known, were designed also including people with disabilities, and it was part of the success of being really easy to use, etc. So in the tech organization, I think we have a bit more of that spirit, but tech is just a way to access to all the other sectors. So sometimes we forget that tech is just a channel. It's just giving us access to a product, to an experience, to a place. So if these places, products, these experiences are not in the same mindset, I think we are still facing a barrier. We can go there, but we can't enjoy it. So Yeah, we have to move, like I would say, the old industries in this viewpoint. And that would make the difference because you brush your teeth far more often than you, I don't know, you want to buy something even on Amazon. Hopefully.
Sure, but,
so, you know, sometimes, as you said at the beginning, like maybe the more useful assistive technology that you use are not the more technologically advanced one, but still they are the everyday ones. It's not in the core spirit of innovation of the company. People with disabilities are still not engaged at the base of innovation. That should change.
I think of it in incredibly simplistic terms. I think of a cafe who have steps outside, and if they think, oh, we've got to put a ramp in for people in wheelchairs, they might not bother. But if they think we will put a ramp in that will benefit people in wheelchairs, mums and dads with children in pushchairs, elderly people with walking sticks, a whole variety of people away from tradition, what you might call disability, I think then they will actually make the effort. And, you know, in a way, it shouldn't be like that. But it feels like actually what you're describing there with the tech companies is very similar in that they need to be persuaded that it's going to benefit lots of people rather than what they consider quite a small community of disabled people. Although, as we know, and the title of this podcast and the whole We the 15 premise is that actually it's not a small community anymore. It never was. People just didn't see it as a large community. We're coming towards the end of our time. Simon, I do just want to ask you, I mean, obviously you're sat there in France, the Paralympics and Olympic Games are around the corner. Take your professional hat off now, but do you feel like the Paralympic Games coming to Paris could have quite an impact on France and the way disabled people are, you know, approached and treated in France? Or do you think it's just a passing show, as it were?
I think it is changing things still because people are talking a lot about it more than before, and always like it's better than before, so it's great. I think we have a progression of the awareness through the society that actually I would say Paralympics would be great to watch. And I think that the best thing we could achieve is that if people were just watching Paralympics and enjoy it, that would be the first step to move things. And I think they are really making a huge effort on that. And I hope it will work.
Bernard, Paralympic year, do you sometimes maybe get, I don't know whether it's a good or bad thing. Obviously, people will tune into the Paralympics. They will see lots of prosthetic limbs. They will see amazing chairs that people play wheelchair rugby in, or they will see amazing chairs that some of the athletes use. It does bring a focus to technology and disability, but you know, obviously within a sporting prism. Do you see any sort of glow after the Paralympics that people are kind of more interested in the world of disability and innovation?
Yeah, I think we've seen this with the London Games 2012. And the thing is, I mean, sports are a great moment, right? Whether it's the World Cup or, I mean, they usually have a way of just fixating people in that moment to see what's possible, to see what the possibilities are. And that's why I think the Paralympic Games are a wonderful place to actually show and help people understand what it means to have a disability. That you could still compete and you know, show the same effort, will, or even more. But I think, unfortunately, you know, just like we forget the World Cup shortly after, I guess whoever wins the games and life continues, how do we eventually shift the mindset? I feel like we have to think like, you know, the best marketing teams in the world. Like, if you look at the way private companies make us keep going back to their brands, it's because they are in our face all the time. You know, they will advertise to us all the time, you know. And while this can be, of course, you know, a little bit overwhelming, it does work. So I think we have to find ways of consistently sending this message that, look, disability, accessibility, assistive tech is part of the human experience, and find a way of taking these games, what happens in these games, into everyday living and make use of all the tools we have. Because it's really about how do we help people not to forget what they saw at the games.
Yeah,
you have to kind of keep reminding them again them again. So if we found a way to do that, whether it's through podcasts, social media, I don't know, whatever it is, but it needs to be consistent, and it needs to be like, we have to do this with an agenda. The same way private companies want to keep their bottom line, they have goals and targets around this. I think it's the only way, because a lot of psychoanalysis is used in marketing, a lot of trying to understand why do people behave the way they do. And I think if we could borrow some of that and bring it onto the advocacy side of disability, it might move the needle a bit further, in my opinion. And that's why I am excited with the work that we do of training entrepreneurs or innovators to think like entrepreneurs, because this is the only way you can get your product out there. And we have to really encourage this sort of thinking in the disability space or in the disability world.
Well, you very neatly there described the We the 15 campaign, and we're making our own little contribution here on this podcast, trying to keep disability in people's minds between Paralympic Games. So well done, Bernard. You almost read my finishing script there. But thank you very much to both of you. It's been a real joy speaking with you, Simon Urier of Senior Descent and Bernard Shearer out in Kenya from the Global Disability Innovation Hub. Thanks very much for your time, both.
Thanks, see you.
Thank you.
Next week's We the 15 episode is all about a subject that affects us every day, whether we like it or not. Yes, it's politics. I'll be joined by two former Paralympic swimmers turned politicians, Carla Qualtro in Canada and David Legger of Sweden.